Reluctant to go back inside just yet, Peter strayed further and further from the USIC base. He would be in trouble, he supposed, if he got suddenly tired or unwell, but it was a risk he was willing to take. His health and endurance would be tested to the limit soon enough anyway, when he delivered himself to the Oasen settlement, with no supplies apart from a Bible and the clothes he stood up in. Stark against the horizon towered two silos or chimneys. He wasn't sure which. Obviously not the big brazier, judging from the shape. But what it was, he couldn't guess. No smoke coming out, so maybe they were silos after all. Might this be one of the many things that Granger had explained to him as she escorted him off the ship? The conversation they were supposed to have had, which he had so embarrassingly forgotten, threatened to grow to mythical proportions. A grand tour of everything, with scripted commentary answering all the conceivable questions. He should bear in mind that there was a limit to how much she could have passed on to him at first sight. He walked toward the silos for 10-20 minutes, but they didn't get any closer. A trick of perspective. In cities, the buildings and streets gave you a more accurate sense of how far or near the horizon was. In natural, unspoiled landscapes, you didn't have a clue. What looked like a mile or two might be several days' journey. He should conserve his energy. He should turn around and make his way back to the base. Just as he'd made this decision, however, a vehicle drove into view, coming from the direction of the silos. It was a Jeep identical to Granger's, but as it came closer, he could see it wasn't Granger at the wheel. It was the big, butch-looking woman who'd been talking to BG in the mess hall earlier on. She smoothed the car to a standstill right nearby and wound down the window.
"Running away from home?"
He smiled.
"Just exploring."
She gave him the once-over.
"You done?"
He laughed.
"Yes."
She tipped her head in a get-in gesture, and he complied. The interior of the vehicle was messy. There wouldn't have been room for him in the back, and humid, without air conditioning. Unlike Granger, this woman evidently didn't feel the need to exclude the Oasen atmosphere. Her skin was shiny with sweat, and the spiky tips of her bleached hair drooped with moisture.
"Time for lunch," she said.
"Seems we just had lunch," he said.
"Or was that breakfast?" "I'm a growing girl," she said.
Her tone tipped him off that she was aware she was hefty, but couldn't care less. Her arms were well-muscled, and her bosom, encased in a bra whose underwiring pushed against the fabric of her white T-shirt, was matronly.
"I was wondering what those are,"
said Peter, indicating the silos. She glanced up at the rearview mirror as they got underway.
"Them? They're oil."
"Petroleum?"
"Not exactly. Something like it."
"But you can convert it into fuel?" She sighed ruefully.
"Well now, that's a question that's got other questions hanging off it. I mean, which way do you go? Design new engines to work with the new fuel? Or monkey around with the fuel so it works with the old engines? We've had some discussions about that over the years."
The way she pronounced the word discussions suggested a personal stake in the matter and a degree of exasperation.
"And who won?"
She rolled her eyes.
"The chemistry guys. They figured out how to adapt the fuel. It's like changing the design of the butt so the butt fits the chair. But hey, who am I to argue?"
They drove past the yellow gazebo. Morrow had left, but the other four were still hard at it.
"Do you ever exercise there?" Peter asked.
The woman still hadn't volunteered her name, and it felt awkward to ask it now.
"Sometimes," she said. "But my job is more physical than some other people's, so..."
"You're a friend of BG's," said Peter. They would be back at the base within seconds, and that would be it. Conversation over.
"He's a fun guy," the woman said. "They should have called him BS. You never know what will come out of his mouth. Keeps things interesting."
"Where did he stand on the fuel question?" She snorted.
"No opinion. That's BG. It takes a lot of muscle to be that weak."
She slowed the vehicle down and parked it neatly in the shade of the main building.
"But he's a great guy," she added. "We get along great. Everybody gets along great. It's a great team.
Except when you disagree." She reached forward to pull the key from the ignition.
Her upper arm just below the shoulder sported a tattoo. Sported was probably the wrong word, since the tattoo involved the vestiges of a name, rendered illegible under a later design of a snake crushing a rodent.
"Best not to think about winning and losing here, Mr. Preacher Man," she said, swinging the door open and heaving her body out. "Take a deep breath and count to a million."
Chapter 9. The choir resumed. Peter did not wish to count to a million. He was ready now, pacing his quarters, itching for his rendezvous. His rucksack was packed and had already tested its weight on his shoulders. As soon as Granger was ready to take him, he would go. His Bible, much annotated, dog-eared and interleaved with paper place markers, was stashed in the rucksack along with his socks, notebooks, and so on. He didn't need to consult it just now. The relevant verses were deeply engraved in his memory. Psalms was the obvious resource, the first port of call if you needed courage in the face of a huge, possibly dangerous challenge. The Valley of the Shadow of Death. Somehow, he doubted that he was about to be taken there. But then, he had a very poor instinct for danger. That time in Tottenham when he almost got knifed. He would have just kept talking to that street gang as they grew in number and pressed more closely and aggressively around him, if it hadn't been for Beatrice whisking him into a minicab. "You are completely insane," she'd said to him, as the doors slammed shut and obscenities ricocheted off the car's surface. "But look, some of them are waving to us," he'd protested, as they accelerated away from the mob. She looked, and it was true. "Dear Peter," she wrote, "what thrilling news that the Oasens have already heard of Jesus. It doesn't surprise me, though. Remember when I asked Usyk what contact there'd been with Christians so far? They were cagey, keen to maintain their Usyk is non-religious stance. But there must have been quite a few Christians among the personnel over the years, and we both know that if you put a real Christian anywhere, things happen. Even the smallest seed can grow. And now you're there, my darling, and you can plant more. Many more." Peter noted that she wasn't mentioning Kurtzberg. Evidently, when she wrote this, she hadn't yet received his most recent message. Maybe she was reading it right now, at exactly the same moment as he was reading hers. Unlikely, but the thought of such synchronous intimacy was too seductive to resist. "Don't agonize about the fact that I'm not there with you. If God had meant us to go on this mission together, he would have fixed it so we did. I have my own little missions here. Not as groundbreaking or exotic as yours, but worthwhile all the same. Wherever we are, life throws lost souls into our path. Angry, frightened souls who ignore the light of Christ while cursing the darkness. Mind you, Christians are capable of ignoring the light of Christ too. There's been a ridiculous fuss in our church since you went away. A storm in a teacup, but it has caused me some grief. A few of our congregation, the older members mostly, have been grumbling that we've got no business preaching the word of God to aliens. The argument goes that Jesus died for humans only. In fact, if you pressed Mrs. Shankland on the issue, she'd probably tell you that Jesus died for white middle-class English people from the home counties. Jeff has been doing a reasonable job as pastor overall, but he's acutely conscious of being a stand-in, and he wants to be popular. His sermons are sincere but safe. He never lays anything on the line like you do. So, the grumblings go on. Why not China? There's millions needing it there, dear. Thanks, Mrs. Shanks, for those words of wisdom. Well, my darling, I really must go now and have a shower, assuming the plumbing hasn't gone bung again, and rustle up something to eat. Supplies of my favourite comfort foods continue to be conspicuously absent from the supermarket shelves. Even the horrid but serviceable low-fat roulettes have been out of stock for days. So I've been forced into the arms of another dessert, a sort of chocolate and raisin eclair made by the local baker. Probably just as well. I should be supporting local businesses anyway. On which edifying note, much love from your excited and admiring wife, B. Peter tried to picture Mrs. Shankland. He had obviously met and talked to her. He'd met and talked to everyone in the congregation. His mind was a blank, though. Maybe he knew her as something other than Mrs. Shankland. Edith,
Millicent, Doris. She sounded like a Doris. Dear B, he wrote, let's groom Mrs. Shankland for a mission to China. She could convert 1,000 people per hour with a few well-aimed words. Seriously, things have begun moving quickly now, and I may not have another opportunity to write to you for some time, a couple of weeks even. A couple of weeks for you, a few days for me, if you know what I mean. It's a scary prospect, but I feel I'm in the Lord's hands. Ironically, at the same time as I've got the feeling that I'm being used by USIC for some purpose that is yet to be revealed. Sorry to sound so mysterious. It's USIC's secrecy about Kurtzberg and their caginess about the indigenous people in general that's made me feel this way. To my great relief, I'm finally over my jet lag, or whatever it should be called in the circumstances. I'm sure I would benefit from some more sleep, and I'm not sure how I'm going to manage that with 72 hours of sunshine coming up. But at least the sense of disorientation is gone. My urine is still bright orange, but I don't think it's dehydration. I think it's something to do with the water. I feel quite well. Rested, if a bit restless. Actually, I'm buzzing with energy. The first thing I'm going to do, once I finish this letter to you, is pack a bag and get myself driven back to the settlement, officially called C2, although some of the men call it Freak Town. Charming, eh? And just be left there. Dumped, if you like. It's no good being ferried about in some sort of protective bubble, venturing out for a quick meet and greet while a USIC chauffeur is parked nearby with the motor running. And if I have my own vehicle, that still seems to say, I'm paying a visit and I'll leave when I've had enough. Bad message. If God has a plan for me here among these people, then I must deliver myself into their hands. Okay, that might not have been the wisest course of action for Paul among the Corinthians and the Ephesians, but I can hardly claim to be in hostile territory, can I? The most hostility I've had to endure so far is Severin being in a bit of a snit with me on the way over. Haven't seen him since, by the way. In my excitement about what's to come, I must try to remember what I have and haven't described to you so far. How I wish you were here with me, seeing it with your own eyes. Not because it would save me the trouble of trying to describe it, although I must admit my lack of skill in that department is becoming ever more obvious, but because I miss you. I miss living through the visible moments of life with you. Without you at my side, I feel as though my eyes are just a camera, like a closed-circuit camera without film in it, registering what's out there second by second, letting it all vanish instantly to be replaced by more images, none of them properly appreciated. If only I could send you a photo or a movie. How quickly we adjust to what's provided for us and want more. The technology that allows me to send these words to you across unimaginable distances is truly miraculous. A blasphemous assertion? Yet as soon as I've used it a few times, I think, why can't I send pictures as well? Peter stared at the screen. It was pearlescent grey, and his text hung suspended in the plasma. But if he adjusted his focus, he could see his ghostly visage, his unruly blonde hair, his big bright eyes, his strong cheekbones, his face strange and familiar. He seldom looked in mirrors. In his daily routine at home, he acted on the assumption that after he'd showered, shaved and pulled a comb through his hair, straight back across the scalp, no styling, there was no way a mirror could help improve his appearance further. During the years when he was permanently wasted on booze and drugs, he'd begun many mornings examining his reflection, assessing the damage from the night before, cuts, bruises, bloodshot eyeballs, jaundice, purple lips. Since he'd straightened out, there was no need. He could trust that nothing drastic had happened to him since he'd last checked. He would notice the length of his hair only when it started to fall in his eyes, whereupon he would ask B to cut it for him. He was only reminded of the deep scar between his eyebrows when she'd stroke it tenderly with her fingers after lovemaking, frowning in concern as though she'd noticed for the first time that he was injured. The shape of his chin only became real to him when he was nestling it in the soft hollow of her shoulder. His neck materialized inside her palm. He missed her. God, how he missed her. The weather is dry just now, he typed. I'm told it will be dry for the next 10 hours. Then it will rain for several hours. Then be dry again for 10 hours. Then rain, etc. All very reliable. The sun is very warm, but not scorching. There are some insects, but they don't bite. I've just had a proper meal. Lentil stew and pita bread. Very filling, if a bit on the stodgy side. The pita bread was made from local flours. The lentils were imported, I think. Then I had a chocolate pudding that wasn't really chocolate. I wonder if it would have passed muster with you, given your highly developed tastes in that area. It tasted fine to me. Maybe the chocolate was real, but the pudding was made of something else. Yes, that's it. He stood up from the table and walked over to the window, allowing the warm light to blaze on his skin. He was aware that the tinted glass rectangle, big as it was, showed only a tiny fraction of the sky out there. Yet even this circumscribed portion was too big to take in at once and suffused with an indescribable variety of subtle colours. B, receiving his missives, would be gazing at a glassy rectangle too. She would see nothing of what he saw, not even his ghostly reflection, only his words. With each inadequate message, her view of him got fainter and foggier. She had no choice but to imagine him in a void, with odd details floating around him like space debris. A plastic ice cube tray, a glass of green water, a bowl of lentil stew. My dear B, I want you. I wish you were standing here with me with the light and warmth of the sun on your naked skin and my arm around your waist, my fingers cradling your ribcage. I'm ready for you. I wish you could verify how ready. If I close my eyes, I can almost feel my chest settling against your breastbone, your legs wrapping themselves around me, welcoming me home. There is so little said in the New Testament about sexual love, and most of it consists of Paul heaving a deep sigh and tolerating it like a weakness. But I feel certain Jesus didn't see it that way. It was he who talked of two lovers becoming one flesh. It was he who showed compassion to prostitutes and adulterers. If he could feel that way toward people who misuse sexual desire, why would he be disappointed if they were happily married instead? It's significant that the only miracle he ever performed for non-emergency reasons, but just because he wanted to cheer people up, was at a wedding. We even know he had no problem with being caressed by a female, or he wouldn't have allowed the woman in Luke 7 to kiss his feet and wipe them with her hair. That's as sexy as anything in Song of Solomon. How did his face look, I wonder, while she was doing it? An old-fashioned religious painting would no doubt depict him staring stonily ahead, ignoring her as if nothing was going on. But Jesus didn't ignore people. He was tender and solicitous toward them. He wouldn't have made her feel like a fool. I know John says, "Love not the world, nor the things of the world. For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, and the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, is not of the Father, but of the world. And the world passeth away, and the lust thereof. But he that doeth the will of God abideth forever." But that's a different point. A point about all the mundane stuff we concern ourselves with. All the baggage of being physical beings. And I think John is being too harsh on people. He assumed the second coming would happen in his own lifetime. It might come any day, maybe tomorrow afternoon. Certainly not centuries in the future. All the early Christians thought that, and it made them intolerant of any activity that wasn't urgently focused on heaven. But Jesus understood. God understands that people have a whole life to live before they die. They have friends and family and jobs and children to give birth to and raise and lovers to cherish. My dear, sexy, wonderful wife, I know you are with me in spirit, but I'm feeling sad that your body is so far away. I hope that when you read this, it will be after a long, refreshing night's sleep full of good dreams and undisturbed by Joshua. In a few hours or days from now, my desire to hold you will still be unfulfilled, but I hope to be the bearer of some glad tidings on another front. Love, Peter. Granger emerged from her vehicle blinking, ready for their rendezvous. She hadn't changed her clothes. Still the same cotton top and slacks, a bit crumpled by now. Her headscarf was inelegantly slung around her neck, speckled with water drops from her hair, which stuck up from her scalp like the fur of a rain-drenched cat. He wondered if an alarm clock had jolted her from a deep sleep, and she'd only had time to splash a few handfuls of water on her face. Maybe it was insensitive to oblige her to drive him again so soon, but when they'd parted, she'd emphasized that she was at his disposal. I'm sorry if this is inconvenient, he said. He was standing in the shade of U6 accommodation wing, just outside the exit door nearest his own quarters. His rucksack hung on his back, already slippery with sweat. It's not inconvenient, she said. Her damp hair, exposed to the attentive air, began to emit faint spidery plumes of steam. And I'm sorry I was grouchy on the way back this morning. The sight of religious passion always freaks me out. I'll try not to be too passionate this time. I meant the alien, she said, pronouncing the word without any sign of having taken Peter's little lecture to heart. He didn't mean to unnerve you, obviously. She shrugged. They give me the creeps. Always. Even when they keep real quiet and don't get too close. He ventured out of the shade and she stepped aside, away from the vehicle, allowing him access to the trunk, which she'd swung open for him. The engine was purring in readiness. You think they mean you harm? He said. No, it's just the sight of them, she said, turning her head toward the horizon. You try and look at their face, and it's like staring into a pile of entrails. I thought of fetuses myself. She shuddered. Please. Well, he said cheerily, stepping up to the vehicle, that's us off on the wrong foot again. Out of the corner of his eye, he observed Granger sizing up his rucksack as he unhitched it from his shoulders. She did a slight double take as she registered that it was his only luggage. You look as if you're going hill walking. Your little knapsack on your back. He grinned as he tossed the bag into the trunk. Valdari, he sang in a mock operatic baritone. Valdara, Valdari, Valdara, ha, 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 ha. Now you're making fun of one of my idols, she said, placing her fist on her hips. Sorry? Bing Crosby. Peter looked at her in bemusement. The sun was still quite near the horizon, and Granger was silhouetted in front of it, the crooks of her arms framing triangles of rosy light. Ah, he said, did Bing Crosby sing The Happy Wanderer too? I thought it was his song, she said. It's an ancient German folk tune, he said. I didn't know that, she said. I thought it was a Bing number. It was all over the airwaves last year. He scratched the back of his head, taking pleasure in the bizarreness of everything today. The endless sky with its outsized sun, the playground under the gazebo, his strange new parishioners waiting for another taste of the gospel, and this dispute over the authorship of The Happy Wanderer. The heir took advantage of his raised arm to find different entry points into his clothing. Tendrils of atmosphere licked him between his sweaty shoulder blades, twirled around his nipples, counted his ribs. I didn't know Bing Crosby was back in fashion, he said. Those artists are beyond fashion, declared Granger with undisguised fervor. Nobody wants mindless dance music anymore, or cheap, sleazy rock. She imitated an arrogant rock star striking a chord on his phallic guitar. Disdainful though the gesture was, Peter found it attractive. A thin arm slamming against the invisible guitar strings pushed her bosom out, reminding him how soft and malleable the flesh of a woman's breast was. People have had enough of all that, she said. They want something with class, something that stood the test of time. I'm all for that, he said. Once they were safely sealed inside the vehicle and driving into the wilderness, Peter raised the issue of communication again. You wrote to my wife, he said. Yes, I sent her a courtesy message to let her know you'd arrive safely. Thank you. I've been writing to her myself whenever I can. That's sweet, she said. Her eyes were on the featureless brown horizon. You're sure there's no possibility of organizing a shoot for me in the Oasen settlement? I told you, they don't have electricity. Couldn't a shoot run on batteries? Sure it could. You could write on it anywhere. You can write a whole book if you want. But to actually send a message, you need more than a machine that lights up when you switch it on. You need a connection to the USIC system. Isn't there a, I'm not sure what to call it, a relay, a signal tower? Even as he uttered the words, they sounded foolish. The territory stretching into the distance ahead was stark and empty. Nope, she replied. We never needed anything like that. You've got to remember that the original settlement was right near the base. Peter sighed, leaning his head hard against the seat. I'm going to miss communicating with B, he said, half to himself, Nobody's insisting you go and live with these people, Granger reminded him. That's your choice. He kept silent, but his unspoken objection might as well have written itself on the windscreen in front of them in big red letters. God decides these things. I enjoy driving, added Granger after a minute or two. It relaxes me. I could have driven you there and back every 12 hours, easy. He nodded. You could have had daily contact with your wife, she carried on. You could have had a shower, a meal. I'm sure these people won't let me starve or get filthy, he said. The one who came out to meet us looked clean enough to me. Suit yourself, she said, and revved the accelerator. They jumped forward with a gentle whiplash effect, and a quantity of damp earth was thrown up behind them. I'm not suiting myself, he said. Suiting myself would mean taking you up on your generous offer. I have to consider what's best for these people. God knows, she muttered. Then realizing what she'd just said, graced him with a big, self-conscious smile. The landscape was no more colorful or varied now that the sun had fully risen, but it had its own sober beauty, in common with all endless vistas of the same substance, whether it be sea, sky, or desert. There were no mountains or hills, but the topography had gentle gradients, patterned with ripples similar to those in windswept deserts. The mushroom-like blossoms, white flower, he supposed, glowed brilliant. It's a lovely day, he said. Uh-huh, said Granger, matter of fact. The sky's color was elusive. The gradations were too subtle for the eye to discern. There were no clouds, although occasionally a patch of air would shimmer and become slightly blurry for a few seconds, before shivering back into transparency. The first few times Peter observed this phenomenon, he stared intently, straining to understand it, or perhaps appreciate it. But it just made him feel as though his eyes were defective, and he quickly learned to shift his gaze elsewhere whenever the blurring began to occur. The roadless earth, dark and moist, and sprinkled with pale blooms, was the most restful sight. Your eyes could just relax on it. Overall, though, he had to admit that the scenery here was less beautiful than he'd seen in, well, quite a few other places. He had expected mind-boggling landscapes, canyons shrouded in swirling mists, tropical swamps teeming with exotic new wildlife. It suddenly occurred to him that this world might be quite a dowdy one compared to his own, and the poignancy of that thought made him feel a rush of love for the people who lived here and knew no better. Hey, I've just realized, he said to Granger. I haven't seen any animals. Just a few bugs. Yeah, it's kind of low diversity here, she said. Not much scope for a zoo. It's a big world. Maybe we're just on a sparse little bit of it. She nodded. Whenever I go to C2, I could swear there's more bugs there than at the base. Also, there's supposed to be some birds. I've never seen them myself. But Tartaglione used to hang around C2 all the time, and he told me he saw birds once. Maybe it was a hallucination. Living in the wilderness can do scary things to the brain. I'll try to keep my brain in reasonable condition, he promised. But seriously, what do you think really happened to him, and to Kurtzberg? No idea, she said. Both of them just went AWOL. How do you know they're not dead? She shrugged. They didn't vanish overnight. It was kind of gradual. They would come back to the base less and less often. They became distant. Didn't want to stick around. Tartaglione used to be a real gregarious guy. Blabbermouth, maybe, but I liked him. Kurtzberg was friendly, too. An army chaplain. He used to reminisce to me about his wife. He was one of those sentimental old widowers who never remarry. 40 years ago was only yesterday for him. It was like she'd never died. Like she was just slow getting dressed. She'd be along any minute. Kind of sad, but so romantic. Observing a wistful glow transfiguring her face, Peter felt a pang of jealousy. Childish as it might be, he wanted Granger to admire him as much as she'd admired Kurtzberg. Or more. How did you find him as a pastor? He asked. Find him? What was he like, as a minister? I wouldn't know. He was here from the beginning, before my time. He counseled the personnel who were having problems adjusting. In the early days, there were people who didn't really belong here. I guess Kurtzberg tried to talk them through it, but it was no use. They bailed out anyway. So Jusik tightened up the screening process, cut the wastage. The wistful glow was gone. Her face was neutral again. He must have felt like a failure, suggested Peter. He didn't come across that way. He was the chirpy type, and he got a boost when Tartaglione came. The two of them really got along. They were a team. They were a hit with the aliens, the natives, whatever you want to call them, making big progress. The natives were learning English. Tartaglione was learning whatever. A couple of insects flew against the windscreen, their bodies disintegrating on impact. Brown juice scrawled across the glass. And then something came over them. Maybe they caught some sort of disease? I don't know. I'm a pharmacist, not a doctor. Speaking of which, said Peter, have you got some more drugs to give the Oasens? She frowned. No, I didn't have time to raid the pharmacy. You need clearance for stuff like that. Stuff like morphine? She drew a deep breath. It's not what you think. I haven't told you what I think. You think we're handing out narcotics here. It's not like that. The drugs we give them are medicines. Antibiotics, anti-inflammatories, simple analgesics. I'm confident they're being used for the correct purpose. I wasn't accusing you of anything, he said. I'm just trying to get a handle on what these people have and don't have. They don't have hospitals then. I guess not. Technology isn't their forte. She pronounced it forte, with almost mocking exaggeration, the way Americans tended to when quoting French. So they're primitives, would you say? She shrugged. I guess. He leaned his head back again and reviewed what he knew about his flock so far. He had only met one of them, which was a small sample by any standards. That person had worn a robe and cowl, which looked as though it was probably handmade. His gloves and boots? Again, probably handmade, albeit to a sophisticated standard. You'd need a machine to sew leather so neatly, surely. Or perhaps just very strong fingers. He recalled the architecture of the settlement. Complexity-wise, it was in a class above mud huts or dolmens. But it was hardly high-tech manufacture. He could imagine each stone being fashioned by hand, baked in rudimentary ovens, hauled into place by sheer human or inhuman effort. Maybe inside the buildings, undiscovered by the likes of Granger, there were all sorts of mechanical marvels. Or maybe not. But one thing was certain. There was no electricity, and there would be nowhere to plug in a chute. He wondered how God would feel about him announcing, right here in the car, that he really desperately needed to know whether B had written to him, and that Granger must therefore turn the vehicle around and drive all the way back to the base. To Granger, it would look like a failure of nerve. Or maybe she'd be touched by the ardency of his love. And then again, maybe what seemed like a backward step would in fact be God pushing him forward. God using the delay to put him in exactly the right place at exactly the right time. Or was he just straining to find a theological justification for his own lack of courage? He was being tested, that much was obvious. But what was the nature of the test? Whether he had the humility to appear weak in the eyes of Granger, or whether he had the strength to push on. Oh Lord, he prayed, I know it's impossible, but I wish I could know whether B has written back to me yet. I wish I could just close my eyes and see her words before me, right here in the car. Okay, Peter, this is your last chance, said Granger. Last chance? To check for a message from your wife. I don't understand. There's a chute in this vehicle. We're still in range of USIC reception. Another 5-10 minutes of driving and we'll lose it. He could feel himself blushing, with a big, daft smile so broad it made his cheeks ache. He felt like hugging her. Yes, please. Granger stopped the vehicle, but did not switch off the motor. She flipped open a hatch in the dashboard and pulled out a slim contraption of plastic and steel, which unfolded to reveal a monitor and miniature keyboard. He made the inarticulate noise of surprise and admiration that was called for in the circumstances. There was momentary confusion as to which of them would take responsibility for switching the thing on, and their fingers met on the back of the console. "Take your time," said Granger, settling back in her seat and turning her face toward the window in a display of respect for his privacy. For nearly a minute, 60 agonizing seconds, nothing manifested on the chute except a computerized promise that a search was underway. Then the screen filled up from top to bottom with unfamiliar words. Bee's words. God bless her, she'd responded. "Dear Peter," she wrote, "I'm upstairs in our study. It's 6 o'clock in the evening, still full daylight. Indeed, nicer than it's been all day. The sun is at a low angle now, mild and buttery yellow, streaming through the window straight onto the wall-hanging collage that Rachel and Billy and Keiko made for me. Those kids must be teenagers by now, but their wonderful depiction of the Ark and its animals is still as cute and eccentric as when it was first done. The way Rachel used bits of orange wool for the lion's mane never ceases to charm me, especially when it's lit up by the evening sun as it is now. One of the giraffe's necks is dangling down, though. I'll have to stick it back into place. I only just arrived home from work. Bliss to be sitting down at last. Too tired to have a shower yet. Your message was waiting for me when I rushed upstairs to check. I can understand that you would be eager to go and live with the Oasis ASAP. Of course God is with you and you shouldn't delay unnecessarily. Try not to sacrifice common sense, though. Remember when that crazy Swedish guy at our Bible study dedicated himself to Jesus? He said his faith in the Lord was so strong that he could just ignore the council's eviction notice, and God would organize a miraculous last-minute reprieve. 2 days later, he's on our doorstep with his bin bag of possessions. I'm not implying you're a nutcase like him, just reminding you that practicalities are not your strong suit and that bad things can happen to ill-prepared Christians just as they can happen to anyone else. We need to strike a balance between trusting in our Lord to provide and showing due respect for the gift of life and this body we've been lent. Which means, when you do go to live with your new flock, please make sure you've got 1. Some way of calling for help if you're in trouble. 2. An emergency supply of food and water. 3. Diarrhea medication. 4. The compass coordinates of the USIC base and the Oasis settlement. 5. A compass, obviously. Peter glanced up at Granger, just in case she was reading over his shoulder. But she was still gazing out the window, feigning deep interest in the landscape. Her hands were loosely clasped in the lap of her gown. Small hands, well-formed, with pale, stubby-nailed fingers. He was embarrassed that, apart from a bottle of green water filled from the tap, he'd taken none of the precautions Bee was urging him to. Not even the diarrhea pills she'd bought for him specially. They would hardly have weighed down his rucksack, those pills, and yet he'd removed them. Why had he removed them? Was he being as foolish as the crazy Swede? Maybe he was indulging a stubborn pride in his minimal baggage, his statement of single-minded intent. 2 Bibles, King James and New Living Translation, 4th edition, 6 indelible marker pens, notebook, towel, scissors, roll of adhesive tape, comb, flashlight, plastic wallet of photographs, t-shirt, underpants. He closed his eyes and prayed. Am I drunk on my own mission? The answer came, as it so often did, in the form of a sensation of well-being, as if a benign substance in his bloodstream was suddenly taking effect. Have you fallen asleep? Asked Granger. No, I was just thinking, he said. Uh-huh, she said. He returned to Bee's message, and Granger returned to her study of the empty scrubland. Joshua is helping me type as usual, lying between the keyboard and the monitor, his back legs and tail obscuring the top row of keys. People think I'm being pedantic when I write numbers out as words or type pounds instead of pound, but the fact is, I have to lift up a comatose cat every time I want to use those symbol keys. I did it just now, and Joshua made that yerp sound that he makes. Last night, he slept right through, didn't utter a peep, purred a bit. Maybe he's adjusting to your absence at last. I wish I could. But don't worry, I'm getting on with things. The Maldives tragedy has dropped out of the media. There are still small articles on the inner pages of some newspapers and a few ads placed by charities for donations, but the front pages and the primetime coverage as far as I can tell from the clips on my phone, have moved on to other things. An American congressman has just been arrested for shooting his wife. Point-blank range with a shotgun in the head while she was swimming in their private pool with her lover. The newspaper journalists must be so relieved. With the Maldives thing, they had to evoke gruesomeness without appearing prurient, whereas with this, they can be as gross as they like. The woman's head was blown off from the jaw up, and her brains, juicy detail, were floating around in the water. The lover was shot too, in the abdomen, possibly aiming for the groin. Lots of supplementary articles about the congressman, his life history, achievements, college graduation photo, etc. The wife looked, when she still had her head, exactly as you'd expect. Glamorous, not quite real. Mira and her husband are getting along much better. I met her at the bus stop and she was giggly, almost flirtatious. She didn't raise the issue of converting to Christianity again, just talked about the weather. It's been bucketing down again. She only got serious when she talked about the Maldives. Most of the islanders were Sunni Muslims. Mira's theory is that they must have displeased Allah by doing bad things with tourists. A very confused young lady. But I'm glad she's no longer in crisis, and I'll continue to pray for her. I'll pray for your Coretta too. Speaking of Muslims, I know they consider it a terrible sin to throw away old or damaged copies of the Quran. Well, I'm about to commit a similar sin. You know the big cardboard box of New Testaments we had sitting in the front room? It looks like they'll have to be dumped. I can imagine this might upset you to hear, given your news about the Oasis being so hungry for the gospel. But we've had some flooding. The rain was ridiculous. It didn't let up for 5 hours, full pelt. There were torrents flowing along the footpaths. The drains just aren't designed to take that kind of volume. It's all right now. In fact, the weather is lovely. But half the houses in our street have suffered damage. In our case, it's just some patches of sopping wet carpet. But unfortunately, the books were right on one of those patches, and it was a while before I realised they'd been soaking up the water. I tried drying them out in front of the heater. Big mistake. Yesterday they were New Testaments. Today they're blocks of wood pulp. Anyway, not your problem. Hope this reaches you before you set off. B. Peter drew a deep breath, past the lump in his throat. Do I have time to write her a reply? He asked. Granger smiled. Maybe I should have brought a book. I'll be quick, he promised. Dear B, he wrote, then got stuck. His heart was beating hard. Granger was waiting, the engine was running. It was impossible. No time for a proper epistle. Think of this as a postcard. I'm on my way. Love, Peter. Okay, that's it, he said, after he pressed the button. His words hung on the screen more briefly than usual. The transmission was almost instant. Maybe the open air was conducive to the chute's function, or maybe it had something to do with the small amount of text. Really? Said Granger. You're done? Yes, I'm done. She leaned across him and replaced the chute in its slot. He could smell the fresh sweat inside her clothing. Okay, she said. Let's hit the road. They spoke little on the remainder of the drive. They discussed the essentials, or agreed not to discuss them further, and neither of them wanted to part on bad terms. The Oasis settlement was visible a long time before they reached it. In full daylight, it glowed amber in the light of the sun. Not exactly magnificent, but not without beauty either. A church spire would make all the difference. Are you sure you'll be okay? Said Granger, when they had a mile or so to go. Yes, I'm sure. You might get sick. Yes, I might. But I'd be surprised if I died. What if you really need to come back? Then the Lord will make it possible for me to come back somehow. She chewed on that for a few seconds, as if it were a dry mouthful of bread. The next official USIC visit, our regular trading exchange, is in 5 days, she said in an efficient, professionally neutral voice. That's 5 real days, not days according to your watch. 5 cycles of sunrise and sunset, 300, she consulted the clock on the dashboard. 360-odd hours from now.
Thanks, he said. It seemed impolite not to make a note of it, if only on his palm. But he knew perfectly well that he was unable to calculate 360 hours into the future, when he'd be sleeping and waking up at various points along the way. He would have to take everything as it came. At the final approach, C2 appeared deserted. Their vehicle pulled up at the outermost of the settlement's buildings, the same place as before, marked with a white star. Except that the building was now marked with something else as well. A large message, freshly painted in white letters, 3 feet tall. WEL space COME. Welcome.
Wow, said Granger.
Didn't know they had it in them.
She stopped the car and flipped open the hatch. Peter got out and fetched his rucksack from the boot, strapping it onto his shoulders so that his arms were free. He wondered what the correct way of taking his leave of Granger might be. A handshake, a courteous nod, a casual wave, or what? The crystalline curtain that veiled the nearest doorway sparkled as its trails of beads were brushed aside to allow someone through. A hooded figure, small and solemn. Peter couldn't tell if it was the same person he'd met before. He remembered the Oasis's robe as being blue, whereas this one's was pastel yellow. No sooner had the person stepped out into the light than another person followed him, parting the beads with his delicate gloves. This one's robe was pale green. One by one, the Oasis emerged from the building. They were all hooded and gloved, all daintily built, all wearing the same soft leather boots. Their robes were all the same design, but there was scarcely a color repeated. Pink, mauve, orange, yellow, chestnut, fawn, lilac, terracotta, salmon, watermelon, olive, copper, moss, lavender, peach, powder blue. On and on they came, making room for each new arrival, but standing as close together as a family. Within a few minutes, a crowd of 70 or 80 souls had gathered, including smaller creatures who were evidently children. Their faces were mostly obscured, but here and there, a whitish-pink swell of flesh peeped out. Peter gaped back at them, light-headed with exhilaration. The frontmost of the Oasis turned to face his people, raised his arms high, and gave a signal. "Amaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaaa floated for 5-10 seconds without pause, a grand communal exhalation, sustained so long that Peter interpreted it as an abstract sound, unrelated to language or melody. But then it incorporated a consonant, albeit an unidentifiable one, and shifted in pitch.
How sweet are some not scarfed awake like me.
In synchronized obedience to an energetic hand gesture from the frontmost oasis, they all stopped at once. There was a huge intake of breath, a 70-strong sigh. Peter fell to his knees, having only just recognized the hymn. The anthem of fuddy-duddy evangelism, the archetype of Salvation Army naffness, the epitome of everything he had despised when he'd been a young punk, snorting lines of speed off piss-stained toilet lids. Of everything he dismissed as stupid when he was liable to wake in a pool of congealed vomit. Of everything he considered contemptible when he was stealing money from prostitutes' handbags. Of everything he laughed off as worthless when he himself was a toxic waste of space. I once was lost, and now I'm found. The conductor gestured again. The choir resumed. Part 2. On Earth. Chapter 10. The Happiest Day of My Life. Peter hung suspended between ground and sky, in a net, his body covered with dark blue insects. They weren't feeding on him, they were just using him as a place to be. Every time he stretched or coughed, the bugs would hover up from his skin or hop elsewhere, then settle back. He didn't mind. Their legs didn't tickle. They were quiet. He'd been awake for hours, resting his cheek on his upflung arm so that his eyes were in line with the horizon. The sun was rising. It was the end of the long night, his fifth night spent among the Oasens. Not that he was among the Oasens now, strictly speaking. He was alone on his improvised hammock, strung aloft between two pillars of his church. His church in progress. Four walls, four internal pillars, no roof. No contents except for a few tools and coils of rope and vats of mortar and braziers of oil. The braziers of oil were cold now, glimmering in the dawn light. Far from serving any religious purpose, they had a purely practical function. Throughout the long dark spell for the duration of each working day, they were ignited to throw light on the proceedings, and extinguished again when the last of the Oasens had gone home and Father Pichter was ready to retire. His congregation were laboring as fast as they could to build this place, but they weren't here with him today, not yet. They were still asleep, he supposed, in their own houses. Oasens slept a lot. They got tired easily. They'd work for an hour or two, and then, whether the task had been arduous or not, they would go home and rest in bed for a while. Pichter stretched in his hammock, recalling what those beds looked like. Glad he wasn't in one now. They resembled old-fashioned bathtubs, sculpted out of a sort of tough, dense moss, as lightweight as balsa wood. The tubs were lined with many layers of cotton-like material, swaddling the sleeper in a loose, fluffy cocoon. 300 hours ago, when he first succumbed to tiredness after the great exhilarations of his first day, Pichter had been offered such a bed. He'd accepted it, in deference to his host's hospitality, and there had been much ceremonial well-wishing for a good, long rest. But he hadn't been able to sleep. For one thing, it was daytime, and the Oasens felt no need to darken their bedchambers, positioning their cots right under the brightest sunbeams. He'd climbed in anyway, squinting against the glare, hoping he might lose consciousness through sheer exhaustion. Unfortunately, the bed itself was an obstacle to sleep. The bed, in fact, was insufferable. The fluffy blankets were soon drenched with sweat and vapor. They exuded a sickly, coconutty smell, and the tub was slightly too small, even though it was larger than the standard model. He suspected it had been carved specially for him, which made him all the more determined to adjust to it if he could. But it was no good. As well as the absurd bed and the excessive light, there was also a noise problem. On that first day, there were four Oasens sleeping near him. The four who called themselves Jesus Lover 1, Jesus Lover 54, Jesus Lover 78, and Jesus Lover 79. And all four of them breathed very loudly, creating an obnoxious symphony of sucking and gurgling. Their cots were in another room, but Oasen houses had no closable doors, and he could hear the sleepers' every breath, every snuffle, every glutinous swallow. In his bed back home, he was used to the barely audible breathing of Bee and an occasional sigh from Joshua the cat. Not this kind of racket. Lying in the house of the Oasens, he reconnected with a long-forgotten episode from his past life. The memory of being lured off the street by a charity worker and put in a hostel for rough sleepers, most of them alcoholics and addicts like himself. The memory, too, of sneaking out of there in the middle of the night back onto the bitter streets to look for his own quiet space to doss down in. So, here he was in a hammock, suspended in his half-built church in the open air, in the absolute desert stillness of the Oasen dawn. He had slept well and deeply. He'd always been able to sleep outdoors, a legacy of his homeless years, perhaps, when he'd lain comatose in public parks and doorways. Lain so still that people would mistake him for a dead body. Without alcohol, it was a bit more difficult to drift off, but not much. The intrusiveness of the vaporous Oasen atmosphere was easier to deal with, he felt, if he surrendered himself to it. Being indoors and yet not truly enclosed was the worst of both worlds. The Oasis houses weren't sealed and air-conditioned like the USIC base. They were ventilated by open windows through which the insidious atmosphere swirled freely. There was something disconcerting about lying tucked up in a bed and imagining every minute that the surrounding air was lifting the blankets with invisible fingers and slipping in beside you. Much better to lie exposed, wearing nothing but a single cotton garment. After a while, if you were sleepy enough, you felt as though you were reclining in a shallow stream, with the water flowing gently over you. On waking today, he'd noted that the exposed flesh of his arms was intricately patterned with diamond-shaped welts, the after-impression of the net. It gave him a crocodilian appearance. For a minute or two, until the marks faded, he enjoyed the fantasy of having turned into a lizard man. His host had taken his rejection of their bed very well. On that first day, several hours after the formal commencement of communal sleep, when Peter had already been sitting upright for a long while, praying, thinking, fidgeting, taking sips from his plastic bottle of water, filling in the time before he dared to offend everyone by escaping outside, he sensed a presence enter his room. It was Jesus Lover One, the Oasis who'd first welcomed him to the settlement. Peter considered pretending to have been jolted out of a deep sleep, but decided that such childish dissembling would fool no one. He smiled and waved hello. Jesus Lover One walked to the foot of Peter's cot and stood there, head bowed. He was fully dressed in his blue robe, complete with hood, boots, and gloves, his hands clasped in front of his abdomen. The lowered head and the cowl obscured his grisly visage, allowing Peter to imagine human features in that shadowy occlusion. Lover One's voice, when it came, was hushed so as not to wake the others. A soft, suppressed sound, eerie as the creak of a door in a distant building.
"You are praying," he said.
"Yes," whispered Peter.
"I also am praying," said Lover One. "Praying in hope for the hearing of God."
The two of them were silent for a while. In the adjacent room, the other Oasis snortled on. Eventually, Lover One added,
"I fear all my praying go astray."
Peter replayed the half-dissolved word in his mind several times. "Astray?" he echoed.
"Astray,"
confirmed Lover One, unclasping his hands. With one, he pointed upward.
"God abide there."
With the other, he pointed downward.
"Prayer go here."
"Prayers don't travel in space, Lover One," said Peter. "Prayers don't go anywhere. They just are. God is here with us."
"You hear God now?"
The Oasis raised his head in rapt attention. The cleft in his face quivered. Peter stretched his cramped limbs, aware suddenly of a full bladder. "Right now, I only hear my body telling me I need to pass water." The Oasis nodded and motioned for them to go. Peter clambered out of the cot and found his sandals. There were no toilets in Oasis dwellings, as far as he'd been able to tell during the first 20-odd hours of his visit. Wastes were disposed of out of doors. Together, Peter and Jesus Lover One left the bedchamber. In the adjacent room, they passed the other sleepers, who lay swaddled in their cocoons, immobile as corpses apart from their raucous respirations. Peter tiptoed. Lover One walked normally, the velvety skin of his boots making no noise on the floor. Side by side, they passed through a vaulted corridor and emerged through a curtain of beads into the open air, if the air on Oasis could ever truly be called open. The sun shone into Peter's swollen eyes, and he was even more aware of how sweaty and itchy the bedding had made him. Glancing back at the building he'd emerged from, he noticed that, in the hour since his arrival, the Oasis atmosphere had been applying its energies to the welcome on the outer wall, loosening the paint's purchase, transforming it into a perspirous froth that now trickled toward the ground, the letters blurred into Cyrillic patterns. Jesus Lover One saw him looking at the remains of the message.
Word on wall, soon gone,
he said.
Word in memory abide.
And he touched his chest, as if to indicate where memory abided for his kind. Or maybe he was signaling heartfelt emotion. Peter nodded. Then Jesus Lover One led him through the streets. Could unpaved paths be called streets if they were wide enough? Further into the settlement. There was no one else about, no sign of life. Although Peter knew that the throng of people he'd met earlier in the day must be in there somewhere. The buildings all looked the same. Oblong, oblong, oblong. Amber, amber, amber. If this settlement and the Usyk base constituted the only architecture on Oasis, then this was a world where aesthetic niceties weren't wanted and utilitarianism ruled. It shouldn't bother him, but it did. All along, he'd assumed that the church he would build here should be simple and unpretentious, to give the message that its outward form didn't matter, only the souls inside. But now he was inclined to make it a thing of beauty. With every step, he grew more desperate to piss, and wondered if Lover One was going to unnecessary lengths to find him a private place to do it. Oasins themselves had no such concern for privacy, at least not when it came to toilet matters. Peter had seen them expelling their waste freely in the streets, unheedful of the loss. They'd be walking along, solemnly focused on where they were going, and then, out of the bottom of their robes, a trail of turdlets would patter onto the earth. Grey-green pellets that didn't smell, and if accidentally stepped on by other people, disintegrated into a powdery pulp, like meringue. Nor did the feces linger long on the ground. Either the wind blew it away, or it got swallowed up by the earth. Peter had not seen any oasis expelling liquid waste. Perhaps they didn't need to. Peter most certainly needed to. He was just about to tell Lover One that they must stop right now, anywhere, when the oasis came to a halt in front of a circular structure, the architectural equivalent of a biscuit tin, but the size of a warehouse. Its low roof was festooned with chimneys. No, funnels. Large ceramic-looking funnels, like kiln-fired vases, all pointing up at the sky. Lover One motioned Peter to enter through the beaded doorway. Peter obeyed. Inside, he was faced with a jumbled array of vats and canisters and kegs, each different and handmade, each fed from tubes that snaked up to the ceiling. The containers were arranged around the sides of the room, leaving the center free. An artificial pond, the size of a backyard swimming pool in the wealthier parts of Los Angeles, glimmered with pale emerald water.
Water,
said Lover One. Very clever, Peter complimented him, having rejected the word resourceful as too difficult. The sight of the full pond and the dozens of tubes fogged with moisture made him only more convinced that he was about to wet himself.
Enough?
Inquired Lover One, as they turned to leave. Hesitated Peter, nonplussed.
Enough water? We pass now?
At last, Peter understood the misunderstanding. Pass water? Of course. Such collisions between the literal and the colloquial. He'd read about them so often in accounts of other missionary expeditions, and had promised himself he would avoid ambiguity at all times. But Lover One's acquiescence to his request had been so low-key, so smooth, that there was no hint of a communication glitch. Excuse me, said Peter, and strode ahead of Lover One to the middle of the street, where he hitched up his dish dasher and allowed the urine to squirt free. After what seemed like several minutes of pissing, he was ready to turn and face Jesus Lover One again. And as soon as he did, Jesus Lover One released a solitary ball of feces onto the ground, a gesture of respect for an unfathomable ritual. like kissing a European the correct number of times on the correct sides of the face.
Now, again, you sleep?
The Oasin pointed back the way they'd come, back toward the sweat-drenched coconut stinky tub in the House of Snorers. Peter smiled noncommittally. First, take me to where our church will be. I want to see it again. And so the two of them had walked out of the settlement, across the scrubland, to the chosen site. Nothing had been built yet. The site was marked with four gouges in the soil to demarcate the four corners of the future structure. And, inside those demarcations, Peter had scratched the basic design of the interior, explaining to the 77 souls gathered around him what the lines represented. Now that he saw his drawing again, on the deserted patch of earth, after a gap of many hours and through eyes bleary with exhaustion, he saw it as the Oasins might have seen it. Crude, mysterious gouges in the dirt. He felt unequal to the task ahead of him. Grossly so. B would no doubt counsel him that this meant he was confusing objective reality with the amount of sleep he'd had. And of course, she'd be right. The site contained a few other traces of the Jesus Lovers' Assembly, the small posset of vomit that one of the infant Oasins had disgorged during Peter's opening speech. A pair of boots, specially made as a gift for Peter, but several inches too small for him. A mistake which appeared to cause neither embarrassment nor amusement, just mute acceptance. A semi-transparent amber water jug, almost empty. A metallic blister foil, medicine courtesy of Usyk, from which the last tablet had been expressed. Two scattered cushions on which a couple of the younger children had snoozed when the grown-ups' discussion strayed too far into invisible realms. Peter hesitated for a few seconds, then fetched the cushions and arranged them one near the other. Then he lowered himself to the ground, pillowing his head and his hip. His weariness immediately began to drain out of his flesh, as if seeping into the soil. He wished he was alone.
You were unsatisfied in our bed.
Jesus Lover One remarked. The sibilant cluster in the third word rendered it unintelligible to Peter. Sorry, I didn't quite hear what you just...
You were... unglad,
said Lover One, clenching his gloves with the effort of finding a pronounceable word.
In our bed, sleep came never.
Yes, that's true, conceded Peter with a grin. Sleep came never. Honesty was the best policy, he felt. There would be misunderstandings enough without creating more with diplomacy.
Here, sleep will come for you,
Lover One observed, indicating with a wave of his gloved hand the open space around them. Yes, here sleep will come for me.
Good,
concluded the Oasin.
Then all will be well.
Would all be well? There seemed reason to hope that it would. Peter had a good feeling about his ministry here. Already, inexplicably felicitous things had happened. Small things, true, not strictly miraculous, but enough to indicate that God was taking a special interest in the way things were panning out. For example, when he told the story of Noah and the flood, at the Oasin's request, and at the instant that the heavens opened in the scripture, it started raining for real. And then there was that amazing occasion after they'd all stopped work for the night and the braziers had been extinguished and they'd been sitting there in the dark when he'd recited the opening verses of Genesis, again at their request, and at the exact instant that God said, "Let there be light," one of the braziers had sputtered back into life, bathing them all in a golden glow. Coincidences, no doubt. Peter was not a superstitious person. Much closer to genuine miracles, in his opinion, were the sincere declarations of faith and fellowship from these people so incredibly different from himself. Then again, there had been a few disappointments. Or not exactly disappointments, just failures to communicate, and he couldn't even figure out why these encounters had fallen flat. He didn't understand what it was he hadn't understood. For example, the photographs. If he'd learned one thing over the years, it was that the best and quickest way of forging intimacy with strangers was to show them photos of your wife, your home, yourself when younger and decked out in the fashions and haircuts of a bygone decade, your parents, your brothers and sisters, your pets, your children. Well, he didn't have children, but that in itself was a talking point. Children, people would always say, as if they hoped he was saving the best photos for last. Perhaps what had gone wrong with his show and tell with the Oasens was that the group was too large. 70-odd people examining his photos and handing them on. Almost all of those people contemplating an image that was unrelated to the commentary he was giving at that point. Although, to be honest, the responses of the Jesus lovers who'd been sitting right nearby, who had the opportunity to make the connection between the image and his explanation of it, were just as hard to fathom. "This is my wife," it said, extracting the topmost of the photographs from the plastic wallet and handing it to Jesus Lover One. "Beatrice."
"Beatrice,"
repeated Jesus Lover One, his shoulders contorting with effort. "B for short," said Peter.
"Beatrice,"
said Jesus Lover One. He held the photograph gently in his gloved fingers, at a strict horizontal angle, as if the miniature Beatrice posing in her mulberry-coloured jeans and imitation cashmere sweater was in danger of sliding off the paper. Peter wondered if these people could even see in the conventional sense, since there was nothing on their faces he could identify as an eye. They weren't blind, that was obvious, but maybe they couldn't decode two-dimensional images?
"Your wife,"
said Jesus Lover One.
"Hair very long."
"It was then," said Peter. "It's shorter now." He wondered if long hair was attractive or repulsive to those who had none at all.
"Your wife love Jesus?"
"She certainly does."
"Good,"
said Jesus Lover One, handing the photograph to the person next to him, who accepted it as though it were a sacrament. "This next one," said Peter, "is the house where we live. It's in a satellite, a town not far from London in England. As you can see, our house is much the same as the houses all around it, but inside it's different. Just like a person can look the same as those all around him, but inside, because of his faith in the Lord, he's very different." Peter looked up to assess how this simile was going over. Dozens of Oasens were kneeling in concentric circles around him, waiting solemnly for a rectangle of card to be conveyed toward them. Apart from the colours of their robes and some slight variations in height, they all looked the same. There were no fat ones, no muscle-bound ones, no lanky lunks, no bent-backed crones, no women, no men. Only rows of compact, standardized beings, squatting in the same pose, dressed in garments of identical design. And, inside each of their hoods, a coagulated stew of meat that he could not translate into a face.
"Needle,"
said the creature called Jesus Lover 54, shuddering.
"Row of needle. Row of knife."
Peter had no idea what he was talking about. The photograph, which showed nothing more than a drab ex-council house and a flimsy metal fence, was handed on. "And this one," he said, "is our cat, Joshua." Jesus Lover One contemplated the photo for 15 or 20 seconds.
"Jesus Lover?"
he asked at last. Peter laughed. "He can't love Jesus," he said. "He's a cat." This information was greeted with silence. "He's not... he's an animal. He can't think..." The word self-consciously came to his mind, but he rejected it. Too many sibilants for a start. "His brain is very small," He can't think about right and wrong or why he's alive. He can only eat and sleep. It felt like a disloyal thing to say. Joshua could do a lot more than that. But it was true he was an amoral creature and had never worried about why he'd been put on the earth. We love him, though, Peter added. Jesus Lover One nodded.
We also love those who have no love for Jesus. However, they will die.
Peter doled out another picture. This one, he said, is my church back home. He almost repeated BG's wisecrack about not winning any architecture prizes, but managed to swallow the words. Transparency and simplicity were what was called for here, at least until he'd figured out how these people ticked.
Needle. So many needle,
said one of the Oasens, whose Jesus lover number Peter hadn't yet learned. Peter leaned forward to look at the picture upside down. There were no needles anywhere to be seen. Just the ugly blockish exterior of the church, lent a modicum of style by a faux Gothic arch in the metal gate surrounding the building. Then he noticed the spikes on the tops of the railings. We need to keep the thieves out, he explained.
Thief will die,
agreed one of the Oasens. Next in the pile was another photo of Joshua, curled up on the duvet with one paw shielding his eyes. Peter shuffled the picture to the back of the pile and selected another.